He'd worn a baklava mask when he took down Sabo's lair with the goon squad in 2004. Plus, it had been dark and the action quick and confusing.
I don't believe so, said Gentry, looking around the room for security threats.
Wires hung off the walls like ivy. Tables and shelves of equipment and boxes and books. Locked file cabinets along the wall. A full-sized photography studio in the corner with a camera on a tripod facing a chair on a riser.
An American, 35 years old, height 5'11", weight 170. You don't carry yourself like a soldier or a cop, which is good.
Court remembered fragments from the man's dossier. Sabo had been trained by the Soviets in electronic surveillance and forgery and other non-lethal black arts. He'd been used to spy on his own people by the Russians, but he had played for both teams, giving Moscow information on his countrymen while providing well-off Hungarians with escapes to get them through the Iron Curtain. His marginal and conditional of half-hearted help of his own people had proven to be just enough to keep a knife out of his chest after the fall of the Soviet Union, though Gentry remembered reading that Laszlo had been no stranger to getting his ass kicked in retaliation for his association with Moscow.
"I'm just a man who needs some of your product. In a hurry," Court said.
Laszlo stood up and reached for a cane leaning against the desk. He leaned heavily on it as he crossed the room to his visitor. Court noted the Hungarian's slumped body and severe limp. This injury had developed since he last saw him 5 years ago. After an eternity, Sabo arrived in front of Court, leaned well into his personal space, put a hand up to the American's chin, and turned his head left and right.
"What sort of product?"
"A passport. Clean, not fake. I need it now. I'll pay for the extra trouble."
Laszlo nodded.
"How is Norris?"
"Norris?"
"Sir Donald Fitzroy's son, of course."
"You mean Philip?"
"Yes. Does Sir Donald still have the summer place in Brighton?"
"I wouldn't know."
"Neither would I, to be honest,"
Sabo allowed with a sheepish shrug.
Court said, "I understand your need to establish my bona fides, but I am in a rush."
Sabo nodded, hobbled to a little bench, one of a dozen in the room, and each in front of a different table or desk covered with computers, microscopes, papers, cameras, and other gear.
"Fitzroy has his own network, his own facilitators of documentation. Why would you be slumming with Laszlo?"
"I need someone good, and someone quick. Everyone knows you're the best."
The Hungarian nodded.
"Maybe that's just flattery, but you are exactly right. Laszlo is the best."
He relaxed.
"I'll do a great job for you. Maybe you can speak to Fitzroy about the service. Put in a good word for Laszlo, you understand."
Court knew to loathe men who referred to themselves in the third person, but he also knew to be polite when in need.
"You get me out of here with clean papers in under an hour, and I will do just that."
Sabo seemed pleased. He nodded.
"I recently came into possession of a consignment of Belgian passports. New serial numbers, not reported stolen.
Perfectly legitimate."
Court shook his head emphatically.
"No, two-thirds of the stolen passports on the market are Belgian. They are guaranteed extra scrutiny. I need something less obvious."
"An informed customer. I respect that."
Laszlo stood, leaned on his cane, and made his way to another desk. He strummed his fingers on a little notebook full of pencil scratches. Then he looked up.
"Yes, I suppose you could pass as a Kiwi. I've had a few New Zealand passports for a long time. Most of my clients these days are Africans or Arabs. Can't pull off a Kiwi, needless to say. Like I said, these books have been around a while, but Laszlo can doctor the serial number when I put in your information without tainting the hologram. No way it can be traced back to a missing lot."
"Fine."
Sabo sat back down and blew out a sigh that showed Gentry the movement was tiring and uncomfortable for him.
€5,000.
Gentry nodded, pulled the money from his pack, showed it to Laszlo, but did not hand it over.
"What about your appearance? I can photograph you as you are, or we can create something more professional."
"I'd like to clean up first."
"I've got a shower, a razor, a suit coat and tie that should fit you. You ready yourself while Laszlo works on the papers."
Court walked down a hall and sniffed his way to a bathroom that reeked with body odor and mildew. The shower was equipped with soap and razors and shears, all laid out for operators and illegal immigrants and criminals who needed to camouflage their nastiness for a few minutes in order to pose for a photograph intended to portray them to cops and border control agents as little Lord Fauntleroys. For the first time in 3 months, Gentry shaved his beard. He'd laid his Walther on the little shelf with the shampoo and the razors. It was covered with lather by the time he finished. Gentry cleaned up his shavings. He saw each brown hair as DNA evidence, so he spent more time collecting his beard than he had cutting it off. He looked at himself in the mirror while he combed his brown hair to the right in a wet part that would disappear when it dried. He was aging in the face, the creases of sun and wind and life itself deepening into his skin. He could tell he'd lost weight since he'd begun the Syrian operation, and soft bags of discoloration hung under his eyes. When he was 26, he'd once gone 4 days without sleep. He'd been tracking an enemy agent in Moscow and was following him to a dacha in the country, when Court's piece-of-shit two-door Lada broke down in the snow. The gray man had to stay on the move overland to keep from freezing to death. Now, at 36, he feared he looked much worse after 4 days of work than he did back then when his extraction team pulled him half-frozen out of the ice and into a helicopter. After he dried off, he pulled his rain-soaked pants back on. He was careful to keep the soggy bandage in place on his leg. He cinched his belt and climbed into his boots and socks. He dressed in a white dress shirt Laszlo had left out for him that was too small for his neck, tied the cheap tie with it carefully, a big knot covering the open collar. A blue jacket that felt like cardboard bunched at his shoulders. He didn't even try to button it. Court slid his pistol onto his hip, tossed the extra mags and his multi-tool in his pocket, and went back into Laszlo's lab. Sabo sat in a wheelchair at a drafting table, leaning over an open passport with a razor. He looked up at his customer for a long moment.
"Quite a metamorphosis."
"Yeah."
"Sit for the picture, please."
There was a small plastic chair on a riser in front of a blue background hanging from the ceiling. A digital camera on a tripod was connected to a computer on a desk a few feet away. Court stepped up on the hollow wooden riser and sat in the chair. He fumbled with his coat and tie while Sabo rolled the wheelchair into position behind the camera.
"We need to think of a name for the passport, a good Kiwi name."
"It's up to you. Whatever is fine." The camera flashed and Gentry began to stand.
"A couple more, please."
He sat back down.
"I have a name for you. Don't know if you will like it."
"Anything is...
it's flashy, dramatic, mysterious."
"Well, I don't think I need..."
"Why don't we call you Gray Man?"
Gentry stared blankly into the camera as it flashed in his face.
"Shit."
Sabo glared at him. Gentry began to stand. He felt movement in his seat. He had shifted his weight to his feet, but his heels felt like they were dropping. Before he could react, his arms flew up to his sides, his borrowed coat bunched up higher on his neck, and his knees raised in front of his eyes. He was falling backwards, the plastic chair sliding back with him. The light around him vanished, and he dropped into darkness, finally landing on his side, his fall cushioned by something soft and wet. The impact, though cushioned by padding, still knocked the wind from his lungs. Reactively, he leapt to his feet, pulled the pistol from his hip, and spun in all directions to both engage any threats and get his bearings. It was a brick-lined pit, a cistern of some sort. Looking up, he saw he'd fallen 12 feet or so from where the riser had opened up to swallow him. Before he could reach for it, the chair raised into the air, its leg held with a thin chain. It clanged back over the edge of the riser and disappeared. A plexiglass trapdoor closed above him, sealing him into the dank container. Slowly, Sabo leaned over the side, looked down through the plastic at his captive, and smiled.
"You've got to be kidding me!" shouted Gentry in utter frustration.
"I presume you are armed. Beasts like you usually are. You might want to think before firing a weapon in there."
Sabo used the tip of his cane to tap the clear lid over the hole.
2 inches of hardened plexiglass. You'll be dodging your own ricochets."
He then tapped his forehead with a bony finger.
"Don't be stupid."
"I don't have time for this, Sabo."
"On the contrary, a little time is all you have left."
Sabo backed away from view. Chapter 13. Gentry ripped off the jacket, the tie, the shirt, and looked around the pit. It was a 7-foot-wide circle, seemed to be some sort of old sewage well. A cylindrical wall of stone around him, too sheer and slick with mildew to climb. The mattresses on which he'd fallen were smelly and rotting. There was a drainage problem, to be sure. He looked under the mats and discovered an old iron water pipe. He wrapped his hand around it and found it to be hot. Budapest's thermal baths were a tourist draw. This pipe likely pumped hot spring water from one location to another. Water pushed through it, dripping and steaming a little where it disappeared into the wall. Court looked up and around. This would be a particularly awful place to die. 10 minutes later, Sabo returned. He stood over Court and smiled. Gentry said,
"Whatever you are planning on doing,
I remember you. You thought I'd forget? 2004, Central Intelligence Agency Super Special A-Team."
Court knew Sabo had not seen his face in the operation in 04. Still, he shouted,
"That's right, and my field team knows where I am right now."
"Pathetic. You aren't with the agency anymore."
"Where did you hear that?"
The 68-year-old Hungarian disappeared for a minute. He returned above the pit, placed a sheet of paper face down on the plexiglass 6 feet above his prisoner's head. Gentry looked up at his own face, an old headshot taken by the CIA for some dirty documentation. Above the photo were the words, "Wanted for questioning by Interpol." It was just a photo and a description. His name was not given.
"American government men sat in a car outside in the street 7 days a week for an entire year after you, shall we say, resigned your position with the agency. They actually thought you'd come to Laszlo for help. Their presence was bad for business, Mr. Grayman."
"Sabo, this is serious. Look, I know you. I know you'll let me buy my way back up. Just name your price. I can call a man and get money wired."
"Sir Donald can't purchase your path to safety. I don't want his money."
Gentry looked up at the man above him, his voice lowered.
"I'd hate to hurt a cripple."
"You're the one who crippled me."
"What are you talking about?"
"You shut up my darkroom. You thought I'd forget?"
"I didn't shoot you."
"No. You were shooting at the Chechen, hit a container of ammonium persulfate, knocked the powder into a bath of aluminum water, and bang! The Chechen is dripping off the ceiling, and poor, helpless Lazo is burned, the nerves of his lower body damaged from inhaling the toxic fumes."
"Shit," Court shrugged. "Whose fault is that? You were helping a terrorist enter the West. The CIA should have sent me back to finish you."
"Maybe they should have. But I've since made friends with the good men of the Central Intelligence Agency. After the FBI came to talk to me, the agency came. They were the ones who told me you were the leader of the group that blew up my warehouse and ruined my legs. Believe it or not, these days, the local CIA station and Laszlo have a reasonably good working relationship."
"Why wouldn't I believe that?
You always did play all sides.
I think our relationship will get even better now that I've called them and told them I have you locked away. They are on their way here to pick you up right now.
The muscles in Court's face twitched. Tell me you did not do that.
I did. I am going to trade you to the CIA in exchange for a little détente. Our relationship is not so good that me handing over their number one target won't make Laszlo's life easier.
How long until they are here?
Under 2 hours. The station chief is ordering up a helicopter full of heavies from Vienna to take you into custody. I told him your reputation was overrated. Old frail Laszlo captured you by himself, after all, but he was undeterred. You warrant a big operation just to carry you away. You will just have to amuse yourself in the meantime while you...
Laszlo, you need to listen very carefully to me.
Look at him shake. Look at the gray man shake like a little...
They aren't sending a team to haul me away. They'll send a wet team. There's a shoot-on-site directive against me. And when they come here to wax my ass, don't expect them to just walk away and leave a witness behind. That's not how these guys operate.
Laszlo cocked his head, seemed to think this over, then said, They won't hurt me. The CIA needs me.
They only needed you until you made that phone call, you dumb son of a bitch.
Sabo's nerves began to show. He shouted,
Enough talk! If you think the Grim Reaper is on the way for you, maybe you should spend the next few minutes asking your God for forgiveness for your sins.
You too.
Laszlo Sabo's wrinkled and confused face disappeared from the glass above Court. Sir Donald Fitzroy's mobile rang at 3. Lloyd pushed the speaker button, though the call had not come from Gentry's satellite phone.
Cheltenham Security.
Good afternoon, Sir Donald. I am calling in regards to an important business matter.
Do I know you?
Our paths have not crossed, I don't believe. You may call me Igor.
Fitzroy was short with the caller. There was more than enough on his plate to where he felt no need to be polite to some heavily accented solicitor.
And you may call me not interested. I am busy. If you have legitimate business, you can bloody well contact my secretary and make an appointment.
Yes, well, the gray man seems to think he represents legitimate business to you. He told me to call, is insisting you will pay handsomely for his safe return.
The gray man is with you.
Indeed.
Which team are you with?
Which team? I am my own team, sir.
Fitzroy and Lloyd looked at one another. Lloyd pushed the mute button. I don't think this is one of our hunters. Sir Donald tapped the button to allow the caller to hear him.
Let me talk to him.
I'm afraid that won't be possible at the moment.
Lloyd hit the mute button again. He turned to the tech at the bank of computers on the wall. The young man said,
The call originated in Budapest, the pest side. He's got some misdirection software on it. I'll try and get it pinned down.
Lloyd looked up at the large map on the wall monitor.
What's Court doing in Budapest, for fuck's sake?
Fitzroy ignored him and hit the speaker box in the middle of the table, releasing the mute yet again.
I may be very interested in accommodating you, Igor. I just need assurance that my man is in fact in your care.
No trust in this world. That's what's wrong. Very well, Sir Donald. Give me a moment. I don't move as quickly as I used to.
There was shuffling through the speakers for nearly a minute, then finally...
Go ahead. Mr. Fitzroy, you may speak.
Lad, is that you?
Gentry's voice, distant or muffled by something.
He called the agency. A kill squad will be here in less than 90 minutes. Don, I'm in...
There was more scratching and shuffling over the speakers. Then the accented voice came back on the line.
You have 1 hour, Sir Donald. Wire 500,000 euros, and I will have your boy spirited away in plenty of time to avert a counteroffer from a competitor. Here is the account number. Do you have a pen?
A minute later, the call was disconnected.
Both Fitzroy and Lloyd looked to the tech. The young Brit with the nose ring shook his head.
Budapest, 6th District. That much we know, but I couldn't pinpoint it closer. There are 250,000 phones in the 6th District. He could have called from any one of them.
Lloyd was annoyed, but in too much hurry to show it. He turned to his captive. Who does he know in Budapest? Fitzroy rubbed his forehead and shrugged.
Think, damn you! Who would Gentry go see there?
Sir Donald lifted his head quickly.
Sir Beau, not in my network, you see. An old counterfeiter. Used to work for the Reds back in...
Lloyd interrupted.
Got an address?
I can get it.
My closest kill team is in Vienna, 100 miles away. No way we can have them there in that time frame. We'll have to pay Sir Beau off to keep Gentry out of the CIA's hands.
Fitzroy shook his head.
Forget it. Sir Beau's a snake. If he called the CIA, he did it to curry favor with them. He just called me because Gentry told him I'd pay for his release. Laszlo Sir Beau will take my money and still give him up to the CIA. He'll fuck me over long before he'll fuck them over.
Will the CIA take Gentry in or kill him?
Irrelevant. If they kill him, they'll cover their tracks. The body won't turn up for weeks, if ever. Abu Bakr won't sign just because we tell him Gentry's on ice. You'll kill my family just the same as if Gentry survived.
Then we have less than an hour to get killers to Sir Beau's location and do the job before the agency boys get there. Gentry's neck was sore from staring up at the plastic ceiling above him. He heard noises near the opening, so he yelled out,
"How are you going to get me out of here before the agency assets come to kill us both?"
Sir Beau's wrinkled face appeared above.
"Once I have Sir Donald's money, the only one leaving here will be me."
"Fitzroy will kill you for double-crossing him."
"Ha! I still have friends in the East. I have been looking for a way out. A 500,000 euros will be just about enough for a new start."
"Look," Court implored. "There's more at stake here than you know. A family has been kidnapped. 2 little girls have been taken. 8-year-old twins. They will be murdered if I don't get to France in time to stop it. You let me out of here, and I swear you'll get your money. You'll get whatever you..."
2 little girls?
Yes.
Murdered?
Not if I can get...
Laszlo laughed cruelly.
"You've obviously mistaken me for a man with a soul. The Russians had it surgically removed 35 years ago. I really could not possibly care less."
He disappeared from Gentry's view. Lloyd called Riegel, reached him in his teak-paneled Paris office. The German answered before the first ring ended. The American asked,
"Do you have assets in Budapest?"
"I have assets everywhere."
Tier 1 assassins?
"No, just a few pavement artists. I could arrange some low-class triggermen, I suppose, but why? Haven't I provided you with enough alpha killers in the past 12 hours? Surely the gray man hasn't chewed through them all yet."
His tone mocked the young lawyer. "We sent teams to the west. Gentry went south to Hungary, apparently to get a passport to use to flee Europe after he's finished in Normandy."
"Prudent. Optimistic, but prudent."
"Yeah, well, it didn't work out so well for him. The forger in Budapest double-crossed him, locked him up. He just called Sir Donald to demand ransom."
"Let me guess. Laszlo Sir Beau."
"How did you know?"
"Let's just say you can't mention Budapest and double-cross in the same sentence without Sir Beau's name coming up."
"Can you get some men to his address in Pest?"
"Of course. Is it just Laszlo, or does he have security?"
"It's more complicated than that. Sir Beau also turned Court into the CIA. They have a team racing to the location now. Supposedly, they're an hour out."
Riegel sighed, resignation now in his voice.
"He falls into CIA hands, and the Lagos contract is history. If they take him, we won't be able to prove to Abu Bakr if he's dead or alive by Sunday."
"Then we can't let that happen, right?"
"You want to send a team to shoot it out with American intelligence? Are you insane?"
"The CIA will think they're men working for Gentry or working for the kidnapper. If your guys are any good, they won't hang around to explain their motivation."
Riegel thought a moment. When he finally spoke, it sounded to Lloyd as if the German was formulating the plan as the words left his mouth.
The Indonesian hit team is in the air at this moment. They are heading to Frankfurt, but they should be over South Central Europe right about now. Maybe we can divert them, get them on the ground and into the city in the next hour. We'll be cutting it razor close, but it's our only chance.
Are they any good?
Yes. They are Kopassus, Group 4. The best shooters Jakarta has to offer. Let me get to work.
Captain Bernard Kilzer checked the altitude on the radio altimeter. It was a Wolfsburg model he was not entirely familiar with, as this plane was rented and not his normal craft. He was flying west-northwest at 37,000 feet. The Bombardier Challenger 605 was state-of-the-art fly-by-wire technology. His duties and responsibilities as a pilot were great, but at this point, 7 hours into his 9-hour flight from New Delhi to Frankfurt, there was little for him and his co-pilot to do other than stay awake, monitor the onboard systems, and scan the afternoon skies. The two pilots had been flying nearly non-stop for 16 hours. Their route had originated in Jakarta, Indonesia, at 2 a.m. local time. They'd flown west, stopped for fuel in New Delhi, and then immediately returned to the sky. Normally, Captain Kilzer and his co-pilot, First Officer Lee, flew corporate heads around Southeast Asia. They also transported Laurent Group scientists, critical IT personnel, anyone who was needed in any one of 15 corporate facilities from the southern tip of Japan to the eastern edge of India. In addition to these work-related trips, Kilzer and Lee also ferried executives and their wives on island-hopping vacations or to lavish parties in Brunei with the Sultan himself. He'd once even shuttled company clients and Philippine call girls to a secluded tropical isle populated by French chefs and Swedish masseuses for a week of indolent debauchery. Kilzner had flown all manner of Loren Group employees, but he'd never transported a group like the one he was hauling now. Behind him in the cabin were six men, Indonesians. They looked to be young military types, but they wore civilian clothing. The cargo hold of the Challenger was full of green canvas rucksacks. The men kept quiet for the most part. On Kilzer's trips out of the cockpit to the lavatory, he'd glanced into the 28-foot cabin and had seen darkness perforated by penlights, some men poring over maps while others slept. They seemed a disciplined group, heading out on some important mission, and Kilzer did not have a clue why he'd been tasked with ferrying them. The bald-headed 38-year-old German pilot reached behind himself to retrieve his lunchbox. The multifunction display flashed. His co-pilot said,
"Ground-to-air call coming through for you from the home office on the secure link."
"Roger."
Kilzer turned away from his meal and flipped a switch on the center console to send the impending transmission into his ears alone.
"November Delta 30 Whiskey, over." "This is Regal speaking. Do you read me?"
Kilzer knew Regal was the VP of security operations for the entire corporation. The German was known as an incredibly tough bastard. Suddenly, Kilzer had a better idea about the mission of the fit young men in the cabin behind him.
"Louds and clear, Mr. Regal. How can I help you, sir?" "How close are you to Budapest?"
"Just a moment."
Kilzer looked to the co-pilot, an Asian with a British accent.
"It's Regal. Wants to know how far we are from Budapest."
First Officer Lee checked his flight's location on the navigation management system. He typed into the keypad on his left and in a few seconds responded.
"We are 107 kilometers south-southeast and 12 kilometers above."
Kilzer relayed the information, and Regal said,
"We have a change in plans. I need you to land there as soon as possible."
Kilzer felt the sting of sweat on the back of his neck. He did not feel good about disappointing the chief of security ops.
"I am sorry, sir. That is not possible. We haven't filed a flight plan for Hungary. We will have serious problems with immigration and security."
"Don't tell me what is possible. Put the airplane on the ground, distribute to the Indonesians their gear, and then get out of there."
Captain Kilzer did not back down immediately.
"How are we supposed to get out of there? We'll be thrown in jail if we land without authorization, if we...
Declare an emergency. Surely you can find a reason to land the plane wherever you want. If you get detained for questioning, I'll pay your way out. We can smooth things over with the Hungarians after the fact. That's not your concern. Just make sure the Indonesians are off the plane before you taxi to the tarmac.
There is too much security at Budapest Ferryig. They will surround the craft, and we will...
Then don't land there. Find a little regional airport nearby, land the plane, and let loose the men in the back. Do I make myself clear?
The captain frantically flipped through the pages on his multifunction display. He scrolled through electronic charts of all the region's airports.
Tokol is 40 minutes driving time from the city center. Its runway is long enough.
Too far. I need the Indonesians in the city center in under an hour.
Kilzer kept looking.
There is Budaörs. It is half the drive time, but the runway is not paved, and it is too short.
How short?
This aircraft with this load requires 1,000 meters on a paved runway in perfect conditions. Budaörs is 1,000 meters exactly, but there is heavy rain, and as I said, it is unpaved. It will be like mud.
Then you should have no problem slowing down before you run out of runway. Land the plane!
You are demanding a crash landing, sir! It will be very unsafe!
If you want to be safe from me, Captain, you will land that plane in Budaörs. Am I clear?
Kilzer gritted his teeth. Riegel said,
I'll have a coach and a driver there to pick them up.
Sir, I need to stress again, this will create an incident.
Let me worry about that.
Roger, sir.
Kilzer disconnected the call. He squeezed his hands on his control column in frustration. The co-pilot asked,
What's going on? Apparently, Lee, you and I are about to help Indonesia invade Hungary.
The first officer turned white.
Riegel is an asshole.
Ja,
said Kilzer. He then flipped a few switches on his center console, took the jet off autopilot, and slowly pushed the controls forward. He spoke into his headset.
Mayday, mayday, mayday! November Delta 30 Whiskey!
Chapter 14. For the next hour, Laszlo Szabó used his computer every 15 minutes to check the numbered Swiss account he'd given Fitzroy. Between his frequent log-ons, he packed a suitcase full of essential items for a permanent road trip, called a local car service, and ordered a limo to wait out front at 4:30. Destination, the Budapest Ferryig Airport. He bought a ticket to Moscow, first class, and then called an acquaintance in the Russian capital to arrange pickup from the airport there. Even with all this activity, he still limped over to the riser and looked down through the glass every now and then to check on his prize. The gray man sat shirtless on the mattresses in the cold pit, his back against the slimy wall and his eyes fixed ahead. Laszlo thought nothing about leaving the young man to die, thought nothing of taking €500,000 from Sir Donald the Fat and then reneging on the deal, thought nothing of the ridiculous assertion that the lives of some poor, pitiful schoolgirls hung in the balance of his quickly orchestrated scheme. He'd not been born a sociopath, but he'd learned his way, executed the tenets of the disorder as precisely and with the same attention to detail as he counterfeited passports. It was no lie when he said it was the Russians who'd removed his soul. He'd lived so long as an informer, had worked with local resistance to help dissidents escape out of the country, and then passed on to the Soviets their roots to the West. He'd played both sides in so many games over so many years that, to Laszlo, there remained no longer any right and wrong, only paths to his own benefit and obstacles to negotiate. At the one-hour mark, he checked his account. The money had not yet been wired. He called Fitzroy to learn there had been a delay at his bank. He needed just a few more minutes. The funds were en route. Laszlo smelled a rat, swore he would go put a few bullets into the gray man's head himself if the money didn't come soon. Then, conversely warned Sir Donald that the CIA would bleed every detail of Cheltenham Security Service's real operation out of its top killer, and Fitzroy's own head would be on the chopping block within a day or two of Sabot handing over the man in his pit to the Americans. Finally, Laszlo granted 15 minutes more to the convincing Englishman, checked on his prisoner in the hole, and then phoned the driver waiting outside and told him he'd be delayed but to keep the engine running. Sabot had been cutting it close all his life. If the CIA killers arrived before he left, he'd likely be killed. If they did not, he'd have his new start in Russia. Captain Bernard Kilzer turned his head slowly to First Officer Lee. The action made the perspiration on his forehead run into his eyes. Lee looked back to his captain and blinked his own sweat away. Both men's faces were chalk white. The Bombardier Challenger stood still in the mud. Out the windscreen, both pilots could see only grass and fence obscured by a heavy rain shower. They had used every centimeter of the runway given them, then an additional 80 meters of soggy open field. There was no more. Kilzer's heart pounded, and his blood boiled. Regal had forced them into this situation, a situation that had come within 3 seconds flying time of ending very, very badly, and even though it had not terminated in a ball of fire and an insurance payout to his wife, the German captain had every expectation he would be spending some time as a guest of the Hungarian penal system. Still, they had survived. This aircraft had been equipped with anti-skid carbon brakes and a gravel kit, deflectors placed around the tricycle gear to keep runway debris from destroying the plane upon landing. Still, Kilzer and Lee both knew their rented Challenger would not be flying out of Hungary under its own power. The gear and engines were surely damaged, and it would take some serious towing equipment to pull this $20 million aircraft out of the sucking mud pit where it now sat. After a few more seconds to recover from the stress and fatigue of the landing, Kilzer shut down all systems, standard procedure for a fire on board. Now the only sound was the pelting rain against the aircraft's skin and windows. In his Mayday message to Budaörs Airport's control tower, he'd claimed he smelled smoke in the cockpit. Had he more time to come up with something, no doubt he and Lee could have conceived a ruse that would have been more verifiable. But from the time he'd gotten the call from Regal to this moment, only 35 minutes had passed. In the interim, his wits were fully occupied as he dropped his jet from 400 knots and 7 miles in the air to a standstill beyond the far edge of a rain-soaked, too-short, unpaved runway at an unfamiliar airport. He'd done damn well, and he knew it. He even thought, in the moment of buoyant optimism that came from the adrenaline high following the landing, that he might just manage to talk his way out of jail time if he could keep his winning streak going a few minutes more. But this pipe dream faded as movement out the windscreen jolted him back to reality. A black van smashed through the fence directly in front of him. The 6 Indonesians appeared from around the starboard side of the Bombardier, pulling rucksacks retrieved from the cargo hold. Hurriedly, they clambered into the vehicle. While Captain Kilzer and First Officer Lee sat silently and stared at the activity in front of their cockpit, the black van backed through the mud and grass from whence it came, skidded in the rainwater on the road on the other side, and then sped off into the storm. That dramatic event, Kilzer knew, would not have gone unnoticed by the control tower behind him. And that dramatic event, Kilzer knew, would land both him and Lee behind bars until that asshole Regal could buy them out. And it occurred to Kilzer as he placed his hat on his head and left the airplane, the rain whipping into his face and his ears assaulted with the shrieking sound of approaching sirens, that Mr. Regal would certainly have other messes to attend to before the day was through. So he and Lee should prepare themselves to be forgotten about for some time to come. The wire transfer appeared in Sabot's account as he was furiously making a third call to Fitzroy. The CIA was due to arrive within 10 minutes. He'd cut it way too close, but now the money was received and he could leave. He hung up the phone as Fitzroy answered. Next, he checked back in on the gray man one final time, bade him adieu and bonne chance, finished packing his suitcase, and then hobbled out of his studio laboratory workshop, shuffling down the hall as quickly as his paralytic body would allow. He was almost to the door when the phone rang. Thinking it was the CIA station chief giving him an update on the progress of the operators on the way, he decided to answer. They wouldn't have called if they were moments away. He lifted the phone off the hook.
"I have fulfilled my side of the bargain. It is time for you to fulfill yours," said Fitzroy.
"I'm impressed, Sir Donald. My phones are scrambled. How did you..."
"I have my ways, Laszlo. Now, free the Gray Man before they come for him."
The sweat already dripping down the 60-year-old Hungarian's back turned ice cold. Fitzroy knew who he was. Sabo realized he'd be watching his back for the wily Englishman for the rest of his life.
"I will release your boy immediately."
"You wouldn't be talking out of both sides of your mouth, would you? Playing a game with myself and the CIA?"
"You have my word as a gentleman."
"Very well, Laszlo. Enjoy the money."
The line went dead. Sabo thought about taking a final step up on the riser, one more glance into the pit, but he decided against it. He hurriedly limped back down the hall, suitcase in hand. He stepped to the small iron door, but it flew inwards as he reached for it. Bright lights shone into the Hungarian's eyes, though it was dark and raining outside. In shock, he leapt back, tripped over his bad leg, and fell onto his back. Squinting the lights away, he saw a team of men dressed in black, hooded faces, a half-dozen gunmen with short-barreled weapons held to eye level. Protruding from each rifle was a powerful flashlight. The first man to him dropped onto a black knee pad. He lifted Sabo by the neck.
"Going somewhere?"
He spoke softly in English. It was the CIA. Sabo could barely see eyes behind the operator's goggles.
I was waiting for you. Just putting the bag in the car, you see. I'll be heading out after you boys finish."
"Sure. Where's the subject?" Sabo was helped back to his feet. All the men in the narrow hall kept their weapons trained ahead.
"He's in the front room, at the end of the hall. Step up on the riser and look down. He's 12 feet down in the cistern, covered with a thick sheet of..."
"Show us." Sabo read the man's voice. There would be no negotiation. He turned and hobbled back up the hallway with the American paramilitaries. Inside the low-lit room, the leader of the SAD unit positioned his 5 men against the walls and stepped to the riser slowly. Laszlo urged him on, told him there was nothing to be afraid of, managed to drop the station chief's name no less than 3 times as a way to let the CIA gunmen know he was one of them. Finally, the heavily armed and armored leader stepped up on the riser and peered warily over into the glass. Laszlo called out, still trying to curry favor.
"He probably has a gun, but he can't use it while the lid is shut. He'd have to be quite a dancer to dodge a ricochet in that little space. Your boss promised Laszlo he'd be taken care of. Maybe I should call him and you can all have a talk so you see everything Laszlo's done for your side. Laszlo the Loyal, he calls me."
The TAC team leader leaned over farther. Then farther. He took a knee over the plexiglass, turned slowly around, back to Sabo.
"What the fuck is this?"
Laszlo did not understand.
"What do you mean?" "It's the Gray Man, all wrapped in a nice bow for my friends at the CIA.
"Did you kill him?"
asked the American operative, standing up now and turning to face the Hungarian.
"Of course not. Why do you ask me this?"
Quickly, the master forger hobbled on his cane towards the riser to see what was wrong. Court had not sat as idly for the past 70 minutes as Sabo had presumed. As soon as the Hungarian left him alone, he pulled his necklace over his head, stripped off the thin leather to reveal a wire saw. He used this to cut away at the exposed water pipe below the mattresses. He'd cut it down in 2 places to where a few more passes of the wire's teeth would open the pipe and fill the cistern with hot spring water in a matter of minutes. Once this was done, Gentry pulled his pistol, ejected the round from the chamber, and retrieved the spare mags from his pants. Using his waterproof boots for a collection bin and the pliers on his multi-tool, he'd pulled each cartridge apart, poured the potassium nitrate-based gunpowder in the boot. When he had the powder from 30 of the 31 bullets he carried on his body collected, he disassembled one of his magazines, removed the spring, reattached the plate, filled it tight with gunpowder from his boot, and then placed the follower at the top, packing the explosive agent tighter in the metal magazine. Court used the magazine spring to bind the follower securely in place. Laszlo checked in on him from time to time. The old cripple made so much noise climbing up on the wooden riser, it was no trick for the gray man to stuff his arts and crafts project below a rotten mattress in time to avoid detection. Now Gentry took off a sock, filled it with the empty cartridges, because the powder would not ignite without help from the primer each cartridge contained. He crammed the powder-filled magazine in the sock and lashed everything together tight with his bootlace. In his fist, he held it. It was a big, heavy sock and roughly the power equivalent of a hand grenade. Gentry feverishly ripped several lengths of fabric from a mattress, tied them together to make a thin strand about 10 feet long. He reloaded his Walther pistol with one remaining round, left the magazine well empty, and tied the gun with more mattress strands to where the muzzle of the 3.5-inch barrel was placed point-blank at the sock full of primers and explosive. The long strand he tied to the pistol's trigger. Finally, Gentry took off his pants. He tied the legs tight at the ankles and then again at the crotch. This created two chambers filled with air. They wouldn't stay watertight for long, but long enough for Court's needs. He used his last shoelace to tie the grenade to the pants. He sat with the pants draped over his legs so Laszlo would not easily notice he wasn't still wearing them. Lastly, he pulled wads of soggy foam from a mattress to use as earplugs when the time was right. Satisfied with his preparations, Court waited. Soon, Sabo leaned over and said goodbye, then disappeared. This was the gray man's cue. Frantically, the American cut the water pipe. Within a minute, the cistern had filled more than knee-deep with water as hot as a bath. Court stood and held the grenade with the pistol affixed to it and the pants with the air chambers, all in his hands. He stood there in his underwear and waited for the water to rise. Within 3 minutes, he floated up with the water and the mattresses, treading in place. After 6 minutes, the cistern was filled nearly to the top. He fought panic. He knew there was no guarantee his contraption would work, or, even if it did, that it would be powerful enough to blow open the trap door. When the water was 3 inches from the plexiglass ceiling, Court forced himself to hyperventilate in the little space. He filled his lungs to capacity and then ducked down below the surface, positioned the floating bomb at one of the hinges. He pushed a mattress between himself and his bomb. Then he swam down to the bottom of the cistern, one hand holding the line of the mattress fabric that led to the pistol's trigger, and the other hand wrapped around the water pipe to hold him at depth. Looking up to make sure everything was in place, he saw his contraption had floated away from the hinge. Quickly, with depleting air reserves, he shot up to the top. Now there was no air here left to breathe. He fought the mattress to the side, repositioned the bomb, and struggled again to the bottom. The day-old gunshot wound in his right thigh burned with the flexion of his muscles. Panic, frantic exertion, and oxygen depletion all seemed to compete with one another to squeeze on his heart and crush it tight deep inside his body. Finally, he reached the water pipe and took hold. He looked back up and saw his device was in place. Shortly before he pulled the cord, he saw a dark figure step onto the riser and kneel down, then turn back to face someone in the room. The team leader said,
"He must be dead. This hole is filled with..."
With a muted pop, the black-clad operator lifted into the air. The plexiglass burst below his feet, white water sprayed in all directions, pieces of sharp plastic tore into the ceiling above. The operator crashed to the left of the riser, a tidal wave of warm water sloshing over him. The other armed men dived for cover. Sabo fell on his back in the middle of the room. The leader was alive. He scrambled to his knees and retrained his weapon on the riser to his left.
"Jesus! All elements, stand fast!"
he shouted, his eardrums ringing from the explosion. Just then, small men in civilian attire and rifles held high poured into the room from the hallway, and gunfire erupted all around. Laszlo Sabo was the first to die. Chapter 15. Even with ersatz plugs, Kort's ears screamed from the pressure of the blast. He pushed off with his feet at the bottom of the cistern and shot to the surface. He had no idea who was waiting above for him. The CIA? Laszlo back for a last check on him? Ultimately, it didn't matter. He needed air. He'd built momentum on the way up, so when his head broke the surface of the water, he shoved open the plastic door. Both hinges were broken off, and the plexiglass was cracked through. He sucked in a huge breath of air and scrambled over the side, rolling off the riser and down to the floor, enveloped in a wave of the warm water. He found himself along the wall in the back corner of the room. All around was the sound of close gunfire and shouting men, but Kort could see no one around the platform's edge. He rolled to his knees into a low crouch and bolted towards the back hallway, his wet feet slapping the linoleum. He didn't take time to look back. Whatever was going down in this room, Gentry had no intention of getting in the middle of it with no firearm and no idea who the players were. The door jammed to the hallway, splintered with a burst of submachine gun fire just a step in front of Gentry's face. He ran right at it, through the overpressure of the supersonic ammo and the flying splinters, down into the dark hall and to the bathroom where he'd shaved an hour and a half earlier. He ducked in quickly for his backpack and threw it over a shoulder. Wearing only his underwear and a bandage on his thigh, he sprinted into a small bedroom at the end of the hall. Over the low twin bed was a window with a thin wire grating. He shattered the glass with a metal end table, lifted the mattress, and pushed it over the windowsill to cover any remaining shards, then rolled out over it into a small courtyard. A door to the building behind Laszlo's was locked, so Kort ran to the far corner of the courtyard. He used iron security bars over a first-story window to climb his way to a second-story balcony where, after four or five tentative kicks from his left heel, he finally shattered a glass window. Loud snaps of gunfire continued below and behind him. He took care to avoid the broken glass left in the pane as he stepped through the window. But as he climbed into the apartment, he cut both his feet stepping in on the carpet. He cried out in pain, fell to his knees, and cut them, too. Crab walking through the small bedroom, he finally stood, hobbled into the bathroom, and rifled through the medicine cabinet. A few seconds later, he sat on the toilet and dressed his fresh injuries. His right foot was okay, a little jab that he poured antiseptic into and wrapped with toilet paper. The ball of his left foot was much worse. It was a relatively deep puncture. He washed it quickly and cinched a hand towel tight around it to stanch the bleeding. It needed stitches, but Kort knew he wouldn't be getting stitches anytime soon. Similar to his feet, his left knee was okay, but his right was badly injured. With a wince, he pulled a shard of glass from his skin, an unlucky barb at the end hooked on his flesh as he removed it. Blood ran down to the floor. "Fuck!" he groaned as he cleaned and dressed the gash as best he could. 3 minutes later, he realized the shooting had died down across the courtyard. He heard sirens, shouting, a baby crying in the next apartment, woken from its nap by the activity. He'd thought the apartment was empty, but when he walked into the living room, still just in his wet boxers but now with wrapped feet and knees, he found an elderly lady sitting alone on a couch. She looked at him with eyes unafraid, bright and piercing and blue. He put a hand out to calm her, but lowered it slowly.
"I won't hurt you," he said,
but he doubted she understood. He mimicked pulling on pants, and she slowly pointed to a room down the hall. There he found men's clothes. A dead husband, maybe? No, a son away at work. He found blue coveralls and climbed into them, and heavy steel-toed boots that were too big but serviceable, with two pairs of white socks. Gentry thanked the lady with a bow and a smile. She nodded back, slowly. He pulled a wad of euros from his backpack and laid them on a table. The old woman said something he did not understand, and, with another bow, he was out the door to the second-floor hallway. Injured, unarmed, with neither means of transportation nor the documents he came all the way to Budapest to acquire, Court Gentry stepped outside and into a steady rain. He looked down to his watch. It was 5 in the afternoon, 8 and 1/2 hours since beginning his journey. He seemed so much farther away now than when he started. At Laurent Group's London office, Lloyd and Fitzroy waited for the news of the Indonesians. It came after 4 p.m., but not from the team itself. Sir Donald's phone rang. It was Gentry.
Chovnum?
It's me. Fitzroy had to compose himself before speaking. Finally, he said,
Thank God! You've gotten clear of Sabo?
Yeah, just.
What happened?
Not sure. Sounded like an SAD field team showed up. Sabo must have had some personal security, and it went loud. Lloyd and Fitzroy stared at one another.
Ah, right. Understood. How are you?
Surviving.
Where are you now?
Still in Budapest. Both Lloyd and Fitzroy looked over to the tech. His head leaned over a computer terminal, but he bobbed it up and down, confirming the truthfulness of the target by pinpointing the cell tower the phone was using.
What now?
Asked Fitzroy. The question was as much to the American on his right as it was to the American on the other end of the line.
I head west. Everything's still on track. Do you have any more information for me?
Yes. The men you met this morning in Prague were Albanians. Simple mercenaries. Hired by Nigerian Secret Service.
They've probably contracted a new team by now. Any idea what I'm up against?
Hard to say, son. I'm working on it.
What do you know about the enemy force structure around your family?
4 or 5 Nigerian secret police types. Not tier 1 gunmen by any stretch, though they have my family scared witless.
As I get closer, I'll need the exact location.
Aye. You'll be there by tomorrow morning?
No. I have a stop to make first.
Not another dangerous detour, I hope?
No. This one is on the way.
Fitzroy hesitated, then said,
Right. Anything else you need from me?
Anything else? What have you given me so far? Look, you are my handler. Handle something. I need to know if I'm going to run into any more goons along my route. I need to know how the fucking Nigerians found out my name. Found out about you. There is something very screwed up here, and I need as much of it figured out as possible before I get to Normandy.
I understand. I am working on it.
Have you had any more contact with the kidnappers?
Sporadically. They think I'm turning over every rock to find you. I'm calling everyone along my network. Just to make it look good, you know.
Keep it up. I'll stay away from the network. Call me if you learn anything.
The line went dead. Within 2 minutes, Fitzroy and Lloyd had more of an explanation about what had happened. Regal called, and between the three of them, they managed to put the pieces together. The 6 Indonesians had been completely wiped out, all dead. The CIA had torched the building to cover their tracks. It was unknown if the agency had taken casualties. Sabo was dead, and Gentry had used another of his 9 lives, but had gotten free.
So, where is he now?
Asked Regal.
Heading west from Budapest.
Via train, car, motorcycle?
We don't know. He called us from a cell phone. He'd apparently pulled it off a passerby, dumped it just after he hung up.
Anything else to report?
Asked Kurt Regal.
Lloyd barked into the phone angrily. You report to me, Regal! What happened to your shit-hot Indonesian Kopassus commandos? I thought you said Gentry would be no match for them.
Gentry didn't kill them. CIA paramilitaries did. Look, Lloyd, We knew the Gray Man would have some resiliency. My plan all along was for one or two teams to knock him off balance, get him reactive instead of proactive. That way, he'll stumble into the next team unprepared.
Lloyd said, We have 10 more teams lying in wait for him. I want him dead before the night is through.
Then we agree on something.
Regal rang off. Lloyd then turned his attention to the Englishman. A pained expression flashed on the older man's face.